One of the speakers I was particularly impressed by earlier on today was a Colin Tudge, who I'm sat with right now. What would you call yourself?
Well, I'm a biologist by origin, and I write for a living. I write books, mainly about biology, also about farming.
So, a lot of research, I imagine.
Yeah, but I've been doing it a long time, at least half a century.
Really?
Well, I mean, I was at school more than half a century ago, and I've been writing for about 40-something years.
And what was the kind of crux of your talk today?
Well, we would need agriculture that could feed 10 billion people. Not right now, but by 2050. It's easy to demonstrate on biological grounds that the only way you can do that is by having farms that are very mixed, very integrated, very low input, because you don't want to, you can't go using all this oil and so on, so on, so on. And what that amounts to is mixed farming, which is basically organic and very, very integrated. Now, if it's those things, it is also therefore very complicated. And if it's complicated, it has to be labour intensive. And it doesn't mean having a lot of slaves, it means having lots and lots of seriously good farmers. If you have a labour intensive system which is integrated and complicated and all the rest, there's no advantage in scale up. And it absolutely then follows that the farm should be small to medium sized. And that's what we need, small to medium sized, etc., mixed organic farms. What the government wants and what big industry wants, and basically the government wants what big industry wants because the government does what big industry tells it. I like to say the government is now just an extension of the corporate boardroom, and it sees itself in that way. They want farms that are as big as possible and as simple as possible and as mechanised as possible. Basically an exercise in industrial chemistry on the sort of grand scale, because they want to keep the cost down, and they're interested primarily in short-term maximisation of productivity.
Now, the idea of what is a big farm has changed somewhat, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I worked briefly, a little-known fact, in the early 1970s for the Farmers Weekly. And I think, if memory serves, the average farm size was 30 acres, which is something like 12 hectares. And a biggish farm was 100 acres, about 40 hectares. Now 1,000 hectares is considered to be quite modest. And if you went to somewhere like Lincolnshire, you might find that 1,000 hectare farm has one full-time labourer. If, however, you go to the Ukraine, well, I mean, it's a bigger place than ours, but you find farms of, not farms really, but units of 300,000 hectares.
So you hesitate to call them farms?
Well, I think it ceases to be a farm, doesn't it? It just becomes a vast area.
A landscape, cultivated landscape.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it would have a single crop, probably wheat.
Have they got rid of all hedges or something? How do they manage?
Oh, God. Oh, it's one big open prairie. Wheat as far as the eye, literally as far as the eye can see. Wheat, wheat, wheat.
That's incredibly depressing in some ways. I'm also reminded of Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful. Was this prophetic in a way?
Oh, I think Schumacher was extremely prophetic. And in a sense, though, I mean, what he is saying is so obviously true. This is the point.
And a lot of what you're saying is like, yes, I believe this deep down.
In a sense, how can you not? I mean, what I like to say, farming should be... Nature is very good at being productive, very good at being resilient, very good at being sustainable. So why don't we just copy what nature does? And if you just look around here, this is not a natural landscape quite, but if you just look around here, what do you see? You see diversity, diversity.
Yeah. And so the key is diversity. So what is the ideal size? Should I want to start farming tomorrow and jack it all in, obviously taking up something else very serious, what would I need to do?
It, of course, depends on what you want to do. Mm. If you were a smallholder, I know some smallholders who make a good living and employ several people on something like 5 acres. That's about, 3 hectares? No, less than that, 2 hectares. I mean, a tiny piece of land, really. Several football fields. That's horticulture, that's intensive horticulture. If you're grazing in a country like this in Wales... Sorry, I just caught a kite out of the corner of my eye.
Yeah, yeah.
Grass, you know, up in the hills. Well, you might have several thousand acres, but we're really talking about the default position, the primary being the small mixed farm, and the ideal, I think, is to get it as small as possible. I would like to have an economy which makes it possible for people to earn a good living off, let us say, 10 hectares, something like that, or you know, 15, 25 acres.
So we're talking a mixture of cattle and poultry and a little bit of growing and...
Yeah, all of that's small enough
to have a selection of raised beds and maybe a polytunnel or two.
All that kind of stuff, very easily on a space that big. Even some arable, although we wouldn't necessarily...
Where would the produce go?
This is the key. This is, well, there are two keys. One point I like is that on a very small farm, it's quite hard to make a serious living. At the moment, certainly it's, but part-time farming becomes a reality. Well worth considering. And, you know, many farmers the world over are part-timers, like, for example, the Scottish crofters, all part-timers. Even in a country like India, where half the people are farmers, many of them will be part-timers. So think in those terms, that makes the economy easier. But when you've got small mixed farms, you've really, most of what you're talking about has got to be for local take-up. That means you have to have the accompanying markets structure, which basically would be a traditional structure, small markets, small shops, etc. Small retailers, you've got to bring back retail, small butchers and so on. Most of all, probably, driving the whole thing along, you've got to get the food culture right. You have to have people around who appreciate good food. If you go to somewhere like southern Italy still, and parts of France still, Switzerland still, you find that the people really do care about food. And then, of course, you could make a living out of a small farm because, you know, that's what they want. And they're queuing up to say, you know, I want really very good lamb, very good beef, very good herbs, whatever. And only those small places can really supply it. That's what we need here. We need to get the food culture back.
And this is in order to, amongst many things, feed an ever-increasing population. But you say there's a ceiling to that increase.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you know about Malthus. Thomas Robert Malthus in the early 19th century, who simply said that the human population is going to go on growing exponentially, in other words, faster and faster and faster, until eventually it crashes because we're bound to exceed our food supply. And that just doesn't seem to be true. If you look at a demographic curve, basically of any species, you find it's S-shaped. And in other words, it goes up very fast for time and then it starts to level out of its own volition, as it were. And this is happening with the human population. This is what the United Nations says. The population, it's not levelling out at the moment, but the percentage rate of increase is getting less, to the point where by the time you get to about 2050, the percentage rate of increase will be zero, which means, by definition, that the population then becomes stable. At that point, the population will probably be between 9 and 10 billion, which is about almost 50% what it is now, bigger. But that is a finite number. It's not going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And if you can feed that many, you've cracked it.
And this levelling out hasn't necessarily occurred due to some major catastrophe or nature deciding enough is enough, here's a funky virus to wipe out half of you.
No. I mean, this is again the thing. Whenever people talk about reducing population, they traditionally tend to talk about war and famine and epidemic. These things do reduce populations enormously, but it's obviously inhumane and foul. We shouldn't even be thinking those terms. But B, it's always temporary. And you can not halve a population with an epidemic or a war, but it'll come bouncing back.
Yeah, there's kind of a spike afterwards, isn't there?
That's right, yeah.
So we're talking about education, we're talking about the liberation in some cultures, mate, but potentially of women who then go on to have less children, better social infrastructure so we don't feel the need to have so many children to look after us in our old age, this kind of thing.
All these things. The one I would sort of not exactly take out of the equation but place least emphasis on, funnily enough, is education, because there's an idea that, as it were, people in charge have, that people at the bottom of who are less well off than them are ignorant and therefore need teaching. This actually is not usually the case. Most people are perfectly happy to have fewer children. It's opportunity people are looking for, and as you said, security. Just knowing that your children are going to live, and that you're not going to be left in your old age with nobody to look after you.
Fascinating stuff. Now, have we taken into consideration, let's say, new nature, or at least the fight it seems to be against nature, whereby transhumanists, for example, are saying that we're going to be tripling our age by 2050? Mm. Now, if it is right that we master the human genome and can stop those little ferrily end bits fraying and the chromosomes not dying, we could be living to 150 plus, could we not? Is this taken into the equation?
Not properly.
If nature is really smart, nature will stop this happening. If we believe that overpopulation is such a terrible thing, maybe it will be made illegal.
It is, although with law you achieve very little, and probably quite rightly. I don't think laws work unless people like the laws.
Which, yeah, fair enough.
The thing about the prolongation of human life, I mean, there's a difference between removing the obstacles to living, as it were, what your normal life would be. Mm-hmm. And I reckon, I don't know, it's a guess, but my guess is that one reason human life is as short as it is, it's because of childhood infection. I'm sure it just takes more out of us than we know. Remove childhood infection and we're going to live longer, possibly to 100. But I can't see in my head, I mean, I'm guessing, that you're going to live to 150 unless you start genetic engineering. And that just seems to me to be beyond the pale. Just don't do it. Ridiculous.
It's been absolutely fascinating. Give me a URL where people can find out more information about your work.
Well, we have a website. We are running a campaign called the Campaign for Real Farming. And we have a website called www.campaignforrealfarming.org. And please do look at it, but also write for it, because it's supposed to be a place, it's a dialogue, it's a forum.
Thank you so much, it's been fascinating.
Thank you very much.